I've made my way across to the AW building, and I'm here talking to, there seems to be a lot of hardware hacking section. Well, this is kind of what the hardware hacking section. I'm going to talk to Paul. Where are you from?
I'm from the UK. I work for Intel, and I'm employed by them to work on the Okta project. So the Okta project is kind of a bunch of commercial vendors from silicon and software that are involved in the embedded Linux sphere, coming together to work with the Open Embedded project on really the core of their build system. So basically, Open Embedded is a system that allows you to cross-build the Linux kernel, bootloader, all of your applications, and put that together into an image that you can flash onto an embedded device. So anything from a phone to a air conditioning control system to something industrial or a development board, whatever it is that you...
Running Intel devices, I guess.
I'm sorry?
Running Intel chips, I imagine.
Intel's just one of the platforms. I mean, we support everything from x86 to ARM, MIPS, PowerPC, so... because we're using GCC, so anything that GCC can build for, we can support.
So I'm just looking at your banner here. It says Open Embedded is a not-for-profit organization for your one recipe to build thousands of packages embedded on your devices, deployed to your users, forget about in nitty-gritty details. That sounds wonderful. Eureka, Texas Instruments are also involved in this. They would be a competitor, I guess.
Definitely. In fact, that's one of the interesting things for me, is working on this project from a silicon vendor. There's quite a number of other silicon vendors involved. The big corporations may be sort of competing in terms of their products, but all of the stuff that we work on is stuff that we don't need to differentiate on, right? We don't want to compete on the version of GREP that we offer in our systems, right? It makes much more sense for us to sit together and work together on those parts.
Okay, so I'm looking here at the table. Can you? I'll take some photos as well for in the show notes. Can you give me a rundown of what I'm seeing here?
Certainly. So start here on the left. We've got an Odroid platform with an external display, and that's a Samsung ARM platform.
So that'll be a little box, slightly bigger than a deck of cards. I see an SD card going in, a power supply. On the back, there's four USB hubs, network connection, nothing here. And then there's loads of stringy wires coming out to a tablet.
Yes. So it's just running some DirectFB graphical demos. So
it's pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
It's pretty impressive.
Oh, well, yes.
It looks like a waterfall, actually.
So the next thing is we've got an Intel Galileo development board. So it's x86 compatible, 32-bit device, kind of designed for sort of wearables and deeply embedded type applications. It's got an Arduino Shield compatibility, so you can take an Arduino Shield and plug that on top.
And does it support, how then do you copy across your sketches for that?
You can use the Arduino IDE to develop it, just as you would with any other Arduino board. So.
Okay, and so what's the advantage of that then over running an Arduino Uno or something?
Well, you have got it's a proper processor with an MMU, so it can actually run a full Linux distribution. It's not maybe as constrained as some of the Arduino platforms that are available. So you can do a little bit more with it.
Okay, so something like that, is this directly competing with something like the Raspberry Pi or something like that?
I guess so. I mean, obviously the Raspberry Pi doesn't have the Arduino sort of plug-on compatibility, but it's of the same order, I guess.
I think you could probably argue it would be more for a professional, where to be running off physical devices based on this rather than have it powering it by a Raspberry Pi.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess... The strength of our platform is that you can build for any of these devices, right, and reasonably easy sort of move your you may prototype on one platform and then move across to another for your production. So,
okay, and this Galileo, how much is that?
I believe it's $69. So
that's not bad actually. And then you could develop on one device, bring your Arduinos over, your Arduino Shields over, and then. Go with that. Okay, cool. Moving on.
Yeah, so this is the Minnow board. This is an Intel Atom-based platform. So it's got a little bit more power than Galileo, and it's got a lot more sort of standard ports that you would expect on that kind of thing. So extra USB, you've got audio and HDMI graphics. So so you've got an actual GPU on the chip there.
And is the drivers for that open?
So the drivers, it's a PowerVR core, so the drivers that we supply for 3D acceleration are proprietary. Well, there is in fact an open source 2D acceleration driver, which has been worked on by a guy in the community, so we do have that.
That's an unfair kicking, because even the Raspberry Pi, they have a proprietary board as well, or not open for the graphics compiler.
Yeah. Apart from that, the entire design of the board, the bill of the materials, everything you would need to build your own board, obviously other than the components themselves, are completely open source. So if you wanted to take this platform, customize it for your application, have it produced, you could do that.
Where's the advantage for Intel in doing that, other than the components are Intel components?
I guess getting the device in people's hands, really, to let them play around and work out, interesting things to do with it.
A rising tide raises all ships, I guess. Okay, moving on. What's the next thing?
So we have, now I know a little bit less about these, but so this is like an industrial computer. I think it's used in vehicles for laying cables. So they when they're drilling, they need to make sure that they are on a straight line. So so this is the control computer that's used in those kinds of applications. So it's an ARM-based platform, has a sort of just five buttons that you can press to interact with stuff that's on the screen. So it's really simple for sort of contractors or whatever doing those kinds of
things. Yeah, I always put gloves, and the buttons are waterproofed, and it looks quite rugged, to be honest with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Oh, I see a little command prompt over here on this device. What's this?
This is a Toshiba development board. It's slightly older, running a Toshiba ARM chip on it.
And it's got a built-in little LCD display, which is quite cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those all-in-one type development boards. It's got everything on it, so you can start developing your application.
What next?
So here we have the Ouya console.
It's tiny.
Typically, as a supplied, has Android on it, but we now have some support in a some community add-on layer that provides you the ability to build for this platform. So
console with Open Embedded.
Yeah, with Open Embedded, yes.
So what is Open Embedded exactly? It's where can I go? What's the website?
So you can go to openembedded.org. From there, you can get information about how to get started, how to access our mailing lists, and all that sort of information, everything you would need to know.
So. Okay, fantastic. And okay, cool. Okay, are there any other devices of interest here, or?
We've got a couple of demos of Internet of Things. So there's a demo here in the middle. I'm not quite sure of the details. I think that he's been having some technical problems getting started. You know how it is with demos at shows. Using a BeagleBone Black. So obviously BeagleBone Black is an ARM-based board with lots of IOs. So so again, that's quite a sort of a common target for Open Embedded. And right on the end here, we have an example of a commercial product that's being developed using Open Embedded. So if you can get more details from Alex on the end here, but it's basically a system for kind of getting a measurement of the occupancy of a building for sort of larger companies who have a lot of buildings that they need to manage. They need to determine whether they're fully utilized. So this system will tell you if particular people are in the office, where they are. You can get statistics out of it. You can book meetings through it, and it'll manage the meeting rooms for you, that sort of thing. So.
Oh, pretty cool. Okay, thank you very much, Paul, for taking the time. And enjoy the rest of the show.
No problem. Thank you.
Hi everybody, this is Ken, and we're over in the AW building, I think, and BS Is it FreeBSD?
That's BSD. It's an all BSD booth because all BSDs like FreeBSD, PCBSD, NetBSD, and partly OpenBSD, they group together at events like FOSDEM, and they do combined booths.
That is very cooperative. You would think, hearing what goes on in mailing lists and stuff, that you all hate each other.
No. We like each other, and we got as a BSD family member. Okay. We have a flyer here, BSD family. We have one kid that's... that doesn't behave that well. I don't want to go into details.
Yes, likes fruit.
Yes.
Okay, so just for the one or two listeners who don't know what BSD is, can you tell us what it is?
You might know Unix was founded in 1968 at MIT. Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie developed... starting exactly from 1966, and then from 1968 beginning, there was C, and then there was Unix. The first release was, official release was 1971 from Unix, and six people started to do a free development of Unix, because development of Unix in the early beginnings was controlled by... corporations like AT&T, and they provided Unix to the universities, but people wanted to have a free software. Yeah. And then in 1973, six people started to develop their own free Unix, and the first release was in April 1975, and that was the beginning of BSD. And over years, BSD was divided into parts like FreeBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD, and Dragonfly BSD, as we now know.
What would you say the strong points of the various different BSDs are?
Three or four points. We have an extremely liberal license. We have a central development. We have a community that's contributing. Not companies, not that much. Like in the Linux world, we have companies that support, but not that much. It's more a free development.
Okay. And which BSD would you run at home, for instance?
Most of the BSD guys run every BSD. Okay. I started with NetBSD, yeah. Then I switched to FreeBSD. I was the founder of Desktop BSD, but mainly I use FreeBSD. But that's only for practical reasons. There's no political or... Most BSD guys use the BSD that's suited best for their needs.
And if you're developing code on one of the BSDs for one of the BSDs, is it portable? Is it going to run on the other ones?
Sure.
And will it also run on Linux?
Yeah. As, normally, you should code portable. At least between the BSDs and better... For all Unix systems.
I think there's a moral of that story for everybody as well.
Yeah.
There was some legal issues at one stage which probably caused people to move to the to Linux over over BSD. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. In 1991, AT&T claimed that BSD had misused legal property of AT&T. BSD denied. And there was two and a half years was a bit of confusion. And before finishing that lawsuit, AT&T and BSD came together and decided there were six files they had to change. We did that within some weeks. And that was the end of that lawsuit.
Okay, and it was put to bed after that. Yeah. I think a lot of people would cite, I mean, you really can't tell the difference between a BSD and a Linux machine if you're unless you have to look for it. Some would even say it's a purer version of Unix.
Yes, sure.
But from what I've seen, the most when talking to BSD users, the philosophy is mostly the license.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a little bit of the difference in the license and why you might choose a BSD license?
Yeah, sure.
And why it might be more free than the GPL?
Yeah. Starting with year 1975, people thought about using the shortest license possibly. That started with four sentences. Then that was kept to three, and now we are at two sentences, and that's enough. And we want to have maybe one sentence should be enough.
And what does that sentence say?
Do whatever what you want, but please don't sue us.
Okay, and keep our name in there.
Yeah, that's all.
Okay. Have you... I'm wondering, recently there's been a push to develop your own compiler. And there's been some controversy, obviously, about that.
No, there was not a controversy about that. It happened that that a new compiler arised with a lot of advantages over the old GCC that's a bit bloated. That's not GCC's fault in it, but GCC supports a lot of platforms. A lot of platforms old, not often used, etc. And we now have an alternative that's better. It's faster. It can compile code that is more compact than GCC. So why don't we use that compiler?
Competition is always good, and that's licensed under the BSD, obviously.
That's under licensing of BSD, but that's not the main point. Because we have BSDs like NetBSD, they're using the latest GCC with GPL version 3.
I thought there was going to be some compatibility issues with BSD.
The problem is the NetBSD supports 57 different platforms.
Yeah.
And GCC is the only compiler that supports the old platforms like MicroVax and stuff like that.
So it runs on my fridge.
NetBSD has to use the latest GPL version 3 GCC compiler. Okay. There's no alternative because CLang and LLVM support only 8 platforms now.
Okay.
Maybe that will rise to 10 or 12 or 14, but they will not develop CCC LLVM for old platforms, no longer produced for 20 years.
Yeah.
So there's no alternative for NetBSD.
Yeah. Have there been any other developments in the BSD world that new and upcoming things?
FreeBSD especially, we have a new release, FreeBSD 10.0. We have to switch from GCC to LLVM CLang. But we have also new platforms like Raspberry. That's absolute brand new, 4 weeks or 5 weeks old. And we have a completely new port system. That's completely revamped now with a lot of improvements because we were a bit behind Debian and DPM, and now we are glad after four and a half years we have a new completely port system that supports NG, new generation, and that's cool stuff.
And is it easy to install software? So I wanted to install, I don't know, Firefox. Or a web browser on there. What would I need to do?
Browse the ports directory. Need to get the latest index.
Yeah.
And then you go to the directory and you only install it, and that's it.
But you're downloading the source code, and the source code is compiling as opposed to
downloading. Or you can use a package.
So there are pre-compiled packages as well.
Yeah.
But that's managed with imports as well.
Yeah. We have the largest collection of free software. Now we have 24,800 ports.
Whoa.
Yes. 24,800 ports with source code, and of that, 22,600 packages.
Wow, that's...
You cannot build each port into a package because of legal issues.
Okay.
That's not under our control.
Okay, are there any obvious gaping holes like, for example, Flash was missing on...
No. That's long, long, long ago.
Flash is available?
For years. Yeah. It's absolutely no problem.
So I could run an entire desktop?
Yes. Yes.
Without any problem?
Without any problem.
You heard it here, folks.
Yeah.
And if I have any problem, I know who to go to now.
We had some problems in the past because Linux was in front of sound.
Yeah.
Now we have better sound than Linux. It's much easier to use sound than in Linux. Way easier.
You're not using Pulse Audio, though.
Yeah. We don't have any Pulse Audio and stuff like that.
Okay. And let me see.
And you can update any machine, and it's running after that update.
And if you have a machine that's running for, say, 2 or 3 years, is it viable to do an update on that?
Sure. We have, in FreeBSD, you have FreeBSD update.
Yeah.
You can even use that on a weekly or monthly basis, if you like. You can do a cron job, as I do. I update my machines automatically every 4 weeks, and if something would go wrong, it never happened now, I would do a drop back to the previous set, and it's absolutely no problem.
Okay.
Updating FreeBSD is so easy. It's easier than any Debian or any Linux I know.
Yes, I may be holding you to those words as time goes on.
I will show you.
Is there anything else that you want to talk to us about, or have I missed?
No. We had a lot of work to do with compiler bases, because when we started to use LLVM and CLang, from the then 23 or 22,000 ports, only 8,000 or 9,000 worked.
Yeah.
Now we have... done a tremendous work the last 2 or 3 years to put that numbers up to 24,800, and now we can use 99.2% of all old applications.
Have you found that any of the people have shrugged off the BSDs? You know, the fact that it didn't compile. Well, I'm not going to worry because it compiled with GCC.
No, we had none. Problem is, we have not run up to the full potential of LLVM CLang, because we have parts that are old, really old. The linker, we switched make to bmake, but we have the old linker. We have no pre-optimization in the linker, and that's missing. We can do a lot better. It's 20 or 30% of the performance gain we are expecting from switching to LLVM CLang is not there yet. We have more work to do. We are faster now than with GCC, but we can do 20 or 30% better.
Oh,
and that's
wow.
our goal.
That's going to be impressive.
Yeah.
That'll really put the smoke over to the GCC guys.
That we are now maybe 5 to 10% faster than GCC, but we want to be 30 or 40% faster.
Okay, that's going to benefit everybody all around.
That will last at least 3 or 4 years.
Could I take then binaries, can I use this on a Linux-based system to compile binaries for a Linux-based system?
No, not yet.
Is there anyone working on that?
You need a complete tool chain to do that. And that's so difficult to change parts of that because the effects are tremendous.
Yeah. Can you do stuff like the Raspberry Pi is not the most powerful device in the world. Can you do cross-compiling for the Raspberry Pi?
We are working now on that. That will be finished end of the year.
Yeah.
We're now working then because from the 24,800 ports, they're not built yet.
Okay.
We are working on that, and it will be finished in October, November, December.
Okay. Cool. Is there anything else that I've...
The guy... working on it, that's Baptiste right over there.
Okay.
That's the guy working on that
thing. Yeah, everybody, the actual people working on projects are awesome. If anything happened, a comet fell on this area.
All the guys are here working on that task.
It will be the way to get rid of...
Next FOSDEM we have planned to sell those Raspberries, which we have here at the booth show. Next year you can buy them. You can buy SD cards with FreeBSD on it and the ports on it. So you plug in your SD card in your Raspberry or in any other similar machine, yeah. And then you're ready, and that's it. Or you can download a complete image,
yeah.
Put it on an SD card or any other flash device you have, and then you're ready, cool. And that's it.
Fantastic stuff. Yeah. Have I missed anything else in the interview?
No, I don't think so.
You're also here with the SSH guys.
Yes.
There seems to be a close relationship between BSD and SSH.
Yeah.
Can you tell us the history of that?
OpenSSH started as a sub-project from OpenBSD,
yeah.
Like OpenNTP, like OpenCVS and stuff like that. After years, people are a bit segregated between OpenBSD and OpenSSH.
Yeah.
The guys now working on OpenSSH are only a small part of it are the old OpenBSD guys.
Yeah.
Most of the guys are came from other projects, from Linux, from whatever.
Yeah, I think you got to have a feel for that sort of
yeah.
thing.
From the developers, only maybe 20 or 30% from the now OpenSSH developers are old OpenBSD guys.
Okay. Your mascot is the devil.
No, it's not a devil. It's a demon.
It looks like the devil. Why do you hate Jesus?
We don't hate Jesus.
Have you had any problems? I know you've had some. I'm being a bit pulling the piss here. I know you've had some issues. Some people going to conferences that they've been absconded. Have you had any issue with that?
No, not in Europe.
No, okay,
not in Europe.
Cool.
People are laughing a lot.
Listen, Hacker Public Radio is always looking for shows, so if ever you want to come on, either to get interviewed or if you want to do your own show, feel free to do it for us.
Yeah, cool.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll see you next year.
Yeah, I'll be there and I'm waiting for you.
Cool.
My name is Cvetan Uzunov. I'm from Olimex, Bulgaria.
Okay, and you're a company here at FOSDEM.
Yeah, we are first time here, like exhibitor at FOSDEM.
And you were saying that you are sponsoring a...
Yeah, it's a hardware hackathon. We want to show to people who are mostly from software development that it's not very hard to deal with hardware and to solve their boards and to see that they work.
Yeah.
And here we have different demo codes with this board, playing Pong game or changing color of RGB LED with the Wii Nunchuk. There is a TV remote control, you can see. I can distantly monitor. And there is a temperature meter. You can measure the temperature with a thermocouple with the same small teeny board.
Okay, hold on. So you've got this little tiny board shaped like a penguin.
Yes.
You've got hackers with soldering irons, which is always a dangerous thing.
Yes, yes.
And they're soldering up the boards. And how much are the boards?
The boards are free.
You're giving the boards away?
Yes, yes. We're giving the boards away here. Because we have some limited space, they just have to wait somebody to stand up so they sit and solder their own board.
So if you solder the board, you get to keep the board.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
And the board is actually an Arduino board, is it?
Exactly. You can work with the Arduino IDE. You can program it. They have bootloader. They have programming blinking LED. So everybody can check his board. If it's working here, you can see what smile they will have on their faces when they see that actually they did something by themselves.
It's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. We're promoting on Hacker Public Radio. We've had two episodes by Mr. X on soldering, which actually work. So this is a good thing.
Yeah.
The main key is not to hold a hot end, I understand.
Yeah, it's very easy to solder the stuff. We specially made this board with the components which are easy to solder. We was talking that yesterday about 100 boards were soldered and all of them were working. So
that is pretty good, actually.
No damaged board. And this is for beginners who never touched soldering iron.
I went to one of our earlier interviews. I was over at the OpenStreetMap project, and they showed me this device.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what that is?
This is open source hardware, Linux computer.
And made by your company?
Yes, okay. Yes. We make everything public with the cut sources, so everybody can study how it's done, modify, create his own board based on this design, and even sell it. So,
how much are you selling that board for?
This is 30 euro board.
And what do I get on it?
You get a Cortex A8 processor with 1 gigahertz, 512 megabytes of DDR RAM. You have SATA, You have HDMI, native Ethernet, two USB ports, and lithium polymer charger. So you don't need expensive UPS. You can create server with just single small battery, and it will run for hours. Like this one, you see?
Yeah, pictures of this will be in the show notes.
Okay, this one is a double core device.
Yeah, it's slightly larger.
Yeah, it has 1 terabyte of hard drive.
A little laptop hard disk underneath, connected with a serial ATA cable.
Yeah, it consumes only 2 watts of energy.
2 watts?
Yeah, so you can make a Tor server or a torrent server for your pictures or movies or something, and put it 24/7, and it will consume only 2 watts.
And one of the issues that I've had with the Raspberry Pi has been the reliability. I can't run it for 24/7. Does your device have any of those issues?
This device has no USB to Ethernet converter. The Ethernet is native. The USB host and everything is designed carefully. So there are not the problems with the Raspberry Pi when you connect many things on the USB ports and it syncs. And you can run for hours from lithium polymer battery. So it's a
regular packet. Connector.
Yeah.
Okay, what sort of devices are you powering here? I see this here. There's a little strip of LED of lights.
It's a demo. It's a Pong game. It's a different. We just wanted to show what is possible to do with this small board. And all these demo projects are put on the website, so people who saw the board can download the demo codes, see the libraries.
What I'm seeing the...
This is 8-20 board running two LCDs. Yeah, one is running Debian, you can see, and one is running Android.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yes, and the video players here use totally open source drivers. So the video accelerator here is made by the open source community. It has no binary blobs. It
100%.
100%
Richard Stallman approved.
Yeah.
Well, actually, are you Richard Stallman approved?
I don't know. I don't know if he knows about our existence.
He might do after this. What other stuff?
Of course, it is still in the very beginning. It supports only MP3 and MP4 formats, but there is a Linux SynC community which is working to open everything on these chips and everything to be without binary blobs with the vanilla kernel. And
And it's running Big Buck Bunny without any problem whatsoever. And the whole table is full of those little penguin devices running. On the table next to that, what have
we
got?
The next table is for our colleague, Cyril may talk. They're from Hackable Devices from France.
Yeah.
They're just separate booths.
Okay.
I don't know
stuff. Listen, I'll put a link to all this in the show notes. Do you need any help or assistance from the hacker community?
Any help is welcome. So.
How are you? So I could take the designs for this and just make it myself. How are you making money?
Yeah, well, the open source, many people think that when they open their work and nobody will buy from them, everybody will start doing it by themselves. But I think in other way, when you do open source hardware, you don't have competitor and you don't have just customer, you have collaborator, because whoever get this design, and if he makes something better or improve it, he send it back.
To you,
so basically, open source hardware help us to make better products. And this is bigger benefit from this that somebody will copy your design, because somebody will copy your design even if it's closed source. And we have example for this. There are some Chinese companies which make similar boards. And everything there is closed source. But when they become successful, in 3 or 4 months, they start being copied by other Chinese companies. So what is your advantage if you're closed source? 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
We just skip this.
Yeah. And then anybody who makes improvements?
And our customers appreciate, because they have better documentation. They can see everything. They can learn something new. And basically, you educate your environment and helping each other. Somebody has said that if you have one apple, another has one apple, you exchange them, you both have one apple. If you have one idea, other has one idea, you exchange, everybody has two ideas.
Very good.
So this is the best part of the open source. You exchange your expertise. For instance, we know hardware, but we are not Linux experts. There are many people who know Linux. They help us. We help them to understand the hardware. They help us to understand Linux. So for these 2 years, we learned a lot out of this project.
Yeah.
And this is also valuable.
Perfect, perfect. Is there anything else that you want to share, or have we covered everything? I'm going to go take some photos of this.
Okay.
And thank you very much for the talk. Hi everybody, this is Ken. We're down in the AW building, not the WC building, which I was going to say. That would be somewhere entirely different. And I'm at the Pandora table talking to Michiel.
Exactly, yes. Hello.
Hi. So tell us, what is the Pandora table? What are you doing here? What is it?
Well, the Pandora basically is a mixture between a gaming console and a mini PC. So it has about the size of the Nintendo DS, has gaming controls and a full keyboard in there, and is running, of course, Linux.
What type of Linux?
Right now it's a version of Open Embedded, because we only have 512 megabytes of storage in there. But for all the files you want to have, there are two SD card slots, so you can put in right now 512 gigabytes of additional storage if you like.
Yeah.
It's a very optimized version which supports our hardware, but it's based on Open Embedded.
Okay, so it's the size of a little lunchbox, I guess, and it's got a small phone screen that you might see on a... Is that a touch screen or not?
That's a touch screen, yeah.
Okay.
We've got a touch screen, but we also got analog controls, which can be used for games or also for mouse usage.
Was this the... Did you do a Kickstarter or a fundraiser for this?
No, because Kickstarter didn't exist when we started with the project. That was back in 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
And it was financed with pre-orders. Then we had a lot of issues because we've never done something like this before. And, well, now it's available for, I think, about 2 years since 2012, right from stock, because we solved all the production issues and production run is now stable. And, yeah, well, I'm working on the successor now, right now as well.
Okay, do you have any prototypes of that available?
The successor, yeah, you can see it right there.
It looks a bit naked at the moment.
Yeah, right. The case is not finished yet. It's just a bare PCB connected to an EVM. But I just got it this week. We just started with the development. But as the development block will be open, so everybody can follow how will such a device be designed and exist. That's why we start from the very early stages to the final product. And what you can see is one of the early stages, but you can already see how fast the CPU will be.
So the original device has got it's about an inch thick, I suppose, when it's closed. A little less.
Yeah.
It's got a full QWERTY keyboard.
D-pad. Gaming controls. Yeah.
I don't play games that much, as you can tell. So, what would I use this thing for?
Well, a lot of people use it for playing games, for retro games, up to PlayStation, Nintendo DS, something like that. For all the Linux games that are out there, or the interpreters like Jedi Knight, Quake, Doom, all that stuff. But of course, you can also use it for internet web surfing, emailing. You can run LibreOffice on it. And, well, that's where the D-pad is handy, because the D-pad actually are the cursor keys as well. So if you're doing some scripting, compiling, coding, or just working on a document in LibreOffice, you've got the cursor keys. And the buttons function is page up and page down, so it's also optimized for working. So, yeah, basically, you can do anything with it. Use it to administer server, play some games in between, whatever you like.
And what sort of connectivity has it got?
Well, it has Wi-Fi built in,
yeah.
Two SD card slots that's mentioned, and we also have a normal full-size USB port, so you can connect any USB device, hard disk, USB stick, directly to the system and copy it over. You could connect a hard disk and run some rescue tools to rescue data from a defective hard disk.
Okay, cool. Can you connect it up to a HDMI screen or something like that?
HDMI not yet, because the old version from 2008 was before HDMI was really popular. But you can connect it to an analog TV out.
Yeah.
But the new version will also have an HDMI out, which is what is currently connected to a monitor, as you can see here.
I'll have a look. So what, with the new device, what are we seeing connected? There's a board and then a separate board. Will they be sandwiched one on top of the other in the final device?
Yes, of course. The final device will be basically the same as we have on the Open Pandora, just with updated hardware and a slightly updated case. So we'll have 3G optionally in there. We have a backlit keyboard, HDMI out, a new processor and stuff like that. That's all on the new unit.
So, yeah, so it'll be if you're into gaming and if you need to do remote support with a QWERTY keyboard, you're set to go. So how did you get involved in this project? How did you wake up one morning and decide to produce essentially a Linux PC?
Well, I always was a fan of things that not a big company with a huge financial funding has, but things that are putting together by a community, which just are motivated to do things, which is what Linux is all about.
Yeah.
And I'm always, since I was a little kid, I always loved computer games. So there were open source handhelds out there, and originally I just was reselling them in Germany because nobody wanted to import them, and I wanted to have those Linux gaming devices out in Germany as well. And then at one time, one of the other distributors had the idea, let's create something like that ourselves. He was crazy enough to start it. I would have never done it. I have to admit that. But then I got involved, was mainly taking care of the community. And since 2012, I am organizing the full production run. And, well, yeah, that's now my second main job, basically.
Do you get a lot of help from hardware hackers in the community?
Not from hardware hackers, but because the product basically is already finished, but from software developers. The community is really, really great. And also the successor, what it has included, is also based on ideas coming from the community. They have the Pandora, and they told us, well, it would be nice to have this and that as well, and then we are looking to if we can include it in a future revision.
Cool. Fantastic stuff. So the future is the next version. When do you expect that to be running? I'm going to have to hold you to this, you know?
Yeah, that's the hardest question. And we had a lot of issues with the Pandora, so we learned to not give out any release dates, any concrete ones. What we have is we've got the blog open, so you can follow the development and then, well, you can guess how long it will still take. And, of course, we gathered a lot of experience with the first device, and we have now reliable companies who are producing that. So it will be a lot faster. We will finish it a lot faster than the Pandora, but we can't give out exact details yet because, well, it depends on so many things. Sometimes it takes 12 weeks or 14 weeks just to get the parts.
And how much are these devices? And can you, will we be able to pre-order those?
Not yet. The pre-order will just go online where, as soon as we have finished prototypes, so with casing and everything finished. And the current Pandora is, well, it starts for €250 for a smaller unit with less RAM and less CPU power, up to €500 for the 1 gigahertz version.
Cool stuff. And can you tell us about the sister project, the ecosystem?
Well, yeah, there are more open source systems using the OMIP 3. That's, for example, the GTA 04, which is basically a PCB for the old OpenMoco phone or for the GTA 02, where you just replace the PCB and then have a faster and new updated CPU as well.
Oh, I've heard about this, actually. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And
how is that related to the Pandora project?
Well, the one who designs the Pyra board right now is the same designer who made the GTA 04, and he also helped me moving the full production to Germany. So I've been in contact with him, and he's also working on a new project right now, which is the Neo 900. And the Neo 900 will be a PCB which will go into the old Nokia N900 phone, which will also have an updated processor.
Is that a useful project for him? Is there anyone really doing that, or are we just hackers here?
I think it is useful for everybody who owns an N900. I've got three N900 because two of them had the USB port broken, which is a common issue on the N900. And now I've got the case, I've got the shell, I've got the screen and everything. All I need to do is get the new PCB, replace it, and I've got a new phone already.
Good stuff. Is there anything else that I missed in the interview?
I don't think so. I think we probably mentioned it everything.
Okay, super duper. Thanks very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
You're welcome. You too. Thanks.
Okay, hi, this is Ken. I've just finished downstairs in the K building, the WAW building, and now I'm upstairs at the K building at Fostem 2014, and the first suckers to get to get conned into an interview are the guys on the Polyphone booth. Who are you?
I'm Christoph Simonis.
I'm Hugo.
And what are you doing at the Python booth?
I'm probably.
So hold on, one step back. What's Python?
So Python is a general purpose programming language used in many different domains, from web services to scientific applications. And
it likes tabs.
It can do a lot of things, so easily we can do sysadministration also with it. You can do graphical application, you can make games also, so
very large. So I think a lot of people, everybody listening to Hacker Public Radio, know what Python is. We've had Python series on how to program. So why do you think Python and Perl have such strong communities?
Well, I think that Python, the emphasis on readability and on good principle of Python, the Zen of Python, is a very strong force of the language.
Yeah.
Together with its good bindings in C, good C libraries, which make it very performant, which means that it's usually more performant to do something in OpenCV or doing scientific computation using Python and C libraries than using other languages like Java, where the whole stack is working in the virtual machine.
You have a sign here, meet us at the Python dev room. So what's going on over there?
It's a bad room. There is a lot of presentation. No, I think there is a presentation about Python SQL will help making SQL queries more easily. There are also a few presentations about the Python, also Python, and also about Python.
So you have several books here. Do you sell those, or are those just an example of
books? It's just an example. It's just an example of books about Python. There are also books available already.
Okay, how would you, if somebody was new to programming, or you know, wanted to get into Python programming, what's the best way to start?
Depending on the person, if the easier part is maybe making games. Yeah. It's easier to start with games. You have a good feedback easily. There is Py games for starting. For other people that's already programming, there is Learn Python the Hard Way. That is a great book.
So one way of learning Python is through books and documentation, and the other one is by doing hands-on. There are many local Python communities where you can learn with other people that can help you. And Python is also quite useful using web frameworks. There are some that are really easy to use, so you can easily connect stuff you have running on your computer to a web interface.
Doing web services with Python, how does that work?
So there are many tiny web frameworks called CherryPy or Flask or Bottle or Web2Py. They are really easy to install. Some of them are just one file or one directory to drop in your project, and then you can use everything that's in them. Some of them include a whole web server, so you can just open your web browser and you have basically content generated from the app you've just written directly in your web browser.
Okay, and these user groups, where could I find out? How do I get involved in the community? What is the advantages of getting involved in the Python community?
Well, the main advantage is that you have people working with the same kind of things as you are. The same reason why people come to FuzzDem is that they learn about other open source software they could use. When you're in a Python community, you learn about other Python libraries you can use, and there are plenty. You can check the website of the Python website. There is an index of all libraries that are available for everyone to install, and there are tens of thousands libraries. So you need, you know, some filter, some recommendation on what to use to do something, and the community helps a lot.
Okay, fantastic. Is there anything else coming up that people should know about in the Python community?
Well, with the new version of Python, there is a lot of work that has been done on asynchronous programming, so you can handle these tasks in a very easy and clear way, much better than, or subjectively much better than with JavaScript or threads.
Okay, fantastic stuff. Thanks very much, guys, for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
I'm at the Jenkins table talking to.
I'm Kosuke Kawaguchi.
So what are you doing here at FuzzDem?
So the Jenkins community has a large presence in Europe, so there's a lot of developers. So this is becoming a sort of tradition to gather and then sort of, you know, greet and then try to evangelize about Jenkins to other people in the community.
I have no idea what Jenkins is. Can you tell me a bit about it?
Yeah, so the Jenkins is what's commonly called as a continuous integration server. The idea is it sort of helps developers by detecting regressions very quickly and notifying people.
So as you're compiling code, you check it in, and then it raises an error?
So as the people are committing changes, you know, sometimes people would cut corners and not always run the entire test suite, or, you know, sometimes tests are too lengthy to run the whole thing. So what Jenkins does is typically it monitors the changes in the source code repository, and it checks out the code and run the build and test, and then tallies the report. So as soon as the regression gets introduced, within a few hours, you get to, you know that there are failure.
And people turn up at your desk.
Sorry, say that again?
People turn up at your desk. So tell me, what's actually involved in setting up a Jenkins server, and what sort of programming languages and commit systems does it support?
One of the things that we spent a lot of effort on is to make it really easy to get started. So Jenkins itself is written as a Java web application, but we package it as a, you know, the Windows installer, Debian package, Red Hat packages, and so on. So typically, all you have to do is like an apt-get install Jenkins, and then it's ready to run, and then everything else.
What license is it released under?
The code is under the MIT license.
Okay. Yeah. So apt-get install and then.
Yeah, and then you get it running, and from then on you can configure everything in the GUI. And in terms of the programming language and the environment that we support, that's another thing that's really great about Jenkins, is that it's got this very active plugin ecosystem. So we have about 850 plugins that's written by people around the world, and you can install any one of them from the update center built inside Jenkins itself.
What type of plugin would that be? What would be a popular plugin?
So, for example, one of the very popular plugins would be like a Git plugin, which basically enables Jenkins to download things from Git. Another popular plugin might be, say, Active Directory plugin. You know, your corporate has Active Directory as identity backend, so you want the users to be logging into Jenkins with their corporate username and password, so you can do that with Active Directory plugin. Yeah, or another popular plugin might be a Chuck Norris plugin. It basically shows...
Chuck Norris plugin?
That's exactly right. So it shows a funny Chuck Norris quote on the Jenkins UI, and if you break the build, he will be angry at you. So those little things that help bring people into the Jenkins.
Nobody wants Chuck Norris on their ass.
That's exactly right.
What sort of tests can you do, and how do I make checks?
Right, so the most of the tests actually still need to be written by you, so unfortunately Jenkins doesn't write the test for you, but what Jenkins does is, you know, the most test framework, they are capable of producing output in machine readable format, you know, like XML files. So you tell Jenkins where those reports are, and then Jenkins would go read them and then produce charts and basically understand what they are. So you can run JUnit or the PHP unit or CPP unit or whatever test format that's supported by Jenkins to work.
That's fantastic. Is there anything, you say this is kind of your European or is it global meetup time?
Yeah.
And how many developers are involved in Jenkins?
So in the core, maybe there's a handful of active contributors. And then if you look at the GitHub Jenkins organization, there are about 800 people registered as a member of the committer community. And then when we look at the number of people who committed to the repository last year, there was more than 1,000 people. So it's a pretty active community that everyone's scratching their little itch in their own plugin. That's sort of how it works in this.
And it's all written in Java?
Most of them are in Java. There are also, you can also write plugins in Ruby to some extent. So there are maybe like a dozen or so plugins written in Ruby. But yeah, mostly in Java indeed.
Okay. And is it quite easy to, would I need to have an understanding of Java in order to be able to use it? Or is it simpler than that?
Yeah, so using it does not require any Java knowledge. But the writing plugin does involve knowing some Java. You know, if 850 people manage to write plugins, I think it's probably not too hard. Yeah.
Excellent. And do you have anything else coming up? do you work for CloudBee? What is the relationship, or is this?
So the CloudBee is a company that I'm involved in, and we have a number of services around Jenkins. So, for example, we have a hosted Jenkins as a service for people who are not interested in running their own instance. We can do that for you. We also have enterprise plugins and a support subscription that's called Jenkins Enterprise by CloudBee. Those other are what we try to help, you know, build around the Jenkins ecosystem.
Is this your first time at FOSDEM, or you've been here loads of times before?
I think it's the fourth time. So I really enjoy the atmosphere of the conference. So I've been here every single year now.
It's pretty awesome, actually, isn't it? Yeah, it's my first time. Okay, cool. And can I get one of these guys?
I wish I could give it to you, but no.
A picture of the little guy will be in there. So. Where did you get the logo? Where did you come up with that?
We did a competition on the logo. We lost the original logo because, So this is done by one of the designers in Texas. He's a contributor of Jenkins project itself, and so he came up with this logo, and the community liked it. So this is
so. Just for our listeners, it looks a little bit like a butler, and I guess Jenkins is supposed to be a butler, somebody who works for you in the background,
exactly,
then brings to your attention some bad news if it should happen.
Yeah.
Okay, listen, thank you very much, KK, for the interview, and enjoy the rest of the show.
All right, thank you very much.
Hi, this is Ken here on Mopas K2, and I'm talking to Bert and Eric from the Puppet Project. How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
So, Eric, you're from the Puppet Labs.
That's right, I'm the product owner for Puppet.
Okay, and you're from? I teach Linux System Administration at University College Ghent.
So, to the people who don't work in system administration land, what is Puppet and what's it used for?
So Puppet's a tool for automating changes that you might want to make to your systems. So instead of having to log on to systems individually and run the same commands over and over, you could run Puppet on those systems, make a change once centrally, and Puppet takes care of distributing that out to all the machines.
Okay, and this would be on a higher level than something like a Red Hat's thing.
Well, there's lots of different config management tools.
Like CF Engine.
Puppet's kind of unique and special because it builds a model of the resources that you're trying to manage on the system, and actually models the dependencies in between those resources in a really powerful way. So if you say need to manage a Apache service, we can make sure that the package is installed, your config file is set up correctly, and the service is started up in the right order. And if the package fails to install, we're not going to blindly try to, you know, restart the service over and over because it just doesn't exist. So Puppet builds a model internally and then walks that as if it was a graph.
And you would have support for different types of operating systems, is that correct?
Yep, runs on all kinds of operating systems, runs on all Linux variants, commercial Unix, and Windows.
Okay, we've had some interviews with people from the CF Engine project before, and they have a philosophy, a view of bringing consistency in, and how would you compare your approach to CF Engine's?
Yeah, well, they're somewhat similar in the sense that CF Engine also builds a list of the things that you're trying to manage on the systems. One of the main differences is that the CF Engine model is autonomous. Each of the systems decides for itself, reads the configuration, decides for itself how it ought to work. And in the Puppet's model, although Puppet can run individually on a machine, you don't need a client-server model. Mostly people run it in client-server mode where the clients submit the information that they know about themselves, what operating system they are, what their kernel version is, into the master, and the master makes decisions on it and returns them a pre-compiled description of what their state ought to look like, rather than the machine going through and doing all this computation independently and therefore requiring access to the entire configuration in order to figure out what it ought to look like. All of that logic is done on the master, and the agents only ever see a representation of what their state ought to be. So all of the stuff about what the other systems look like, all the other branches that weren't walked as we were compiling that catalog, don't ever make it onto the client. So that provides a nice security model, as well as the data transfer over the network works out to be a lot smoother than having to manage pushing out configuration individually to the machines.
Is there a functionality to recover from errors in config files as time goes along? So a config file gets corrupt by an admin logging in on the machine itself. Is there an ability to push down fixes?
Sure. You mean if the puppet's configuration itself gets corrupted?
Or somebody logs on to web server 1 and then adds a new virtual host and makes a typo rather than controlling it centrally.
So absolutely. We generally call that drift remediation. Yeah. Like people making changes on the systems manually is drift from what the desired state is, from what they ought to look like. And absolutely, Puppet has a really intelligent set of algorithms for figuring out whether the system as it exists whether the state as it exists on the running system is it the way it's supposed to be or not, and then bring in line if it's out of line.
Okay, cool. So what sort of license is it released under?
It's all Apache licensed.
Okay. And you're the Belgian Puppet user group. So what's the benefit of having a user group at all?
So we started last year, about a year ago, and we meet every now and then, every month, every 2 months, with a couple of people that are using Puppet or starting to use Puppet, and we exchange experiences, talk about what we've learned and where we still have some troubles. So we exchange information and get better.
And how do you make a profit on this open source system?
Yeah, so Puppet Labs manages a bunch of open source projects. We bundle those projects up into one commercial product, which is Puppet Enterprise. And Puppet Enterprise not only has like long-term support and stability, has a great performance-tuned installation out of the box rather than having to cobble together this sort of really pretty complicated stack of the right Ruby version, the right web server. We put all that together, make it so it's super easy to install. It's highly scalable, and we provide long-term support for that platform and get it running on the main target operating systems that our enterprise users care about. So in addition to all of that, there are some cool value-added features that are only available in Puppet Enterprise, some more GUI functionality for helping less advanced system administrators get started really easily and consume pre-made content on the Forge, which is our community site, and use that to configure the systems instead of having to write everything from scratch.
And is that released under proprietary licensed?
Puppet Enterprise is, it's a renewable yearly software license, so it's not
open source.
Most of the projects are dual licensed in the sense that you pay us for a software license to continue to use Puppet Enterprise for a year. Yeah.
So what's coming up in the near future?
Oh, there's lots of great stuff coming out. One of the speaking specifically about Puppet Enterprise, we've completely revamped the installation mechanism for the next version that'll be out in March. So to make it really easy to build a scaled out installation right from the start. There's a bunch of stuff in the individual projects, the open source stuff upstream, that have been moving really fast. You have a lot of great new innovations that have come out, like a new parser and evaluator for the language that's way more powerful and flexible and also faster. We have structured facts support, so you can have rich data structures that are returned up from your agents. So instead of having to have an individual fact for each one of the network interfaces, say, all those interfaces get bundled together in a big nested hash that is keyed off the interface name, so it makes it a lot easier to get at the data around them.
Sorry, what do you call them, facts or facts?
Yeah, facts. Yeah, so a fact is a little bit of information about the system that as I said at the beginning of that life cycle, the clients discover all the facts about themselves with a program called Factor, F-A-C-T-E-R. It's kind of like a little pun, I guess. A very little pun.
Yeah.
Then all those facts are things that either systems administrators write themselves in order to, say, teach Factor about their application and about how their systems are configured, or just are generically available and synced down to the agents from modules that you download or included in Factor out of the box.
Okay. So I guess the whole point of this is somebody gets a rack of new servers in and you turn them on and it pixie boots and then you should be able to auto-deploy them. Is that sort of what your project's doing?
Yeah, yeah. Everything after, I mean, Puppet squarely aimed, like, everything after that base OS installation gets on, what needs to change on the systems in order to make it so that you can actually get some value out of them.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Listen, guys, thank you very much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And if ever you want to come back or do your own show on Hacker Public Radio, feel free to do so.
Sure.
Cool.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.